So I'm going to talk about the early stages of the shear banding instability in a shear thinning surfactant solution, and this is work I've been doing with Peter Olmsted at the University of Leeds. So, by way of very brief introduction, by now I'm sure is all that's necessary, just want to remind ourselves very briefly of the basic features of shear banding and of the system in which it's most commonly observed, that being worm-like micellar surfactant solutions. Then I'm going to talk about the experimental work that motivated this theory on the formation of shear bands, the kinetics of shear banding formation in these worm-like micelles, talking separately about a regime in which the system's unstable to forming bands and then metastable to forming bands. I'll then get on to talking about the theory for this to try and model the early stages, the early time regime in the unstable regime for the formation of shear bands. And I'll do this using the non-local Johnson-Sabin model, initially without any coupling to concentration, just assuming that the concentration remains uniform throughout the sample. And then I'll allow concentration to become a relevant dynamical variable by coupling the Johnson-Sabin model to the tube fluid model to allow concentration to fluctuate as well. And as a preamble to all this theoretical stuff, I'll discuss a possible analogy of the instability in the shear banding formation with the conventional Carnot-Hilliard or spinodal fluid-fluid demixing instability in conventional equilibrium phase separation. So shear banding then, I'm sure we're all familiar with this by now.
So there's so many, it's essential to tell us which one.
Okay. So this is the original one. So the usual experience then in steady shear is that we see a homogeneous strain rate and stress field. However, if the underlying flow curve that emerges, say, from a calculation, model calculation for any particular material has a piece of negative slope, this is unstable because it would say that a system flowing faster has less stress. So instead of remaining homogeneous, the system then is supposed to separate into a high shear band, like so, and a low shear rate, like so, and then in a steady state measurement, one doesn't measure this wiggle, but instead a characteristic plateau, like so. And as one adjusts the average strain rate for the cell as a whole across this plateau region, we see the relative fraction of these two bands adjust in a way that is reminiscent of conventional phase coexistence in equilibrium, first order phase separation in equilibrium systems with a conserved order parameter. And just as there's an apparent analogy with conventional phase coexistence in the ultimate banded state, so there is in the kinetics as well. So I've already said there's a region here in which the system's absolutely unstable to forming bands, but then it seems experimentally that there's a region of metastable kinetics here as well. So in the language of conventional first-order phase separation, then we'd have binodal points here and spinodal points here. And in this talk, I'm going to be focusing only on the region of instability in here, in particular looking at the early time regime of that, the basic process by which the bands begin to form. So that's the basic phenomenon. The system, which is most commonly observed, are these so-called worm-like micellar surfactant systems, so surfactant molecules like so in water with salt or counterion co-surfactant as well. So a concentration phi, or volume fraction, in fact, at low concentrations, we just see surfactant molecules dispersed throughout the solution. But the point is that the head piece of each surfactant molecule likes to be next to water, and the tail likes to hide away from it. So at concentrations, volume fractions above some critical micellar concentration, we see reversible assembly of these molecules into micellar structures, spheres, worms, or sheets, whatever. For the purposes of this talk, I'm interested in worms, like so. And then at higher concentrations still, these worms can get entangled with each other and form something that looks a bit like an entangled polymeric system, so the usual reptation dynamics, with the important difference now that these are living polymers that can break and recombine, like so. So theories for the rheology of these systems then, done by Mike Cates. So if this breaking process and recombination is fast enough, then the linear rheology is supposedly Maxwellian, and I think this has been observed now in quite a number of systems. And then for the non-linear rheology, the shear stress as a function of strain rate is initially, in the steady state flow curve, is initially predicted to increase, and then as the micelles become progressively better aligned with the flow, the stress in the regime where the micelles are well aligned, the stress is supposed to decrease with shear rate like so. And then if we add a Newtonian piece that comes from the solvent or whatever, we add these up, we get this characteristic wiggle like so and expect to see a banding occurring. So that's the warm-up then. So the experimental data that motivated this theory. So these particular experiments done by Sandra LaRouge for her PhD work at the University of Metz, although there have been other nice ones as well. So I'm specifically going to be talking about the experiments of the kinetics of banding formation. We've already heard by now that there have been many nice experiments on the ultimate steady state when bands are formed, which seems to be not so steady according to the NMR experiments of Paul Callahan and also birefringence experiments. So these experiments by Sandra LaRouge then, the steady state has the characteristic plateau of the shear banding scenario, and Sandra observed nice birefringence effects in these systems. In terms of the kinetics, when we sweep the stress very rapidly upwards like so, the strain rate initially can track up the steady state branch, but when the stress then is in excess of the ultimate steady state plateau value, we see departure along a metastable branch like so. And then when this branch is starting to curve over in a way that sniffs like there'd be an unstable branch of negative slope over here, the strain rate jumps very rapidly over to the high shear branch, which is not shown here. So that's stress-controlled startup experiments. In strain-controlled startup experiments, so jump the shear rate from zero into this metastable regime here, into this regime here. So we find that the stress very rapidly attains this metastable branch that's been established via the stress sweep, and then very slowly on a time scale that can greatly exceed the Maxwell time by a factor of several hundred, slowly evolves down to this steady state value, like so. And the time scale of this slow evolution becomes progressively shorter as one gets to this region where the metastable branch is curving over into what would look like an unstable regime. And at such shear rates, we do indeed see all hell breaking loose in the kinetics. So this slow sigmoidal relaxation now has all but gone away. There's a huge stress overshoot followed by oscillations which very rapidly subside to the steady state value of the stress.
Is that the ringing of the instrument at all?
Excuse me?
Is that the ringing of the instrument at all when you're trying to do this jumping?
This?
Yeah.
Not according to the experimentalists. I mean, I'm not intimately acquainted with the experiments, but I'm sure that it's not.
When you try and do a very abrupt jump in shear rate, the instrument rings for a while, doesn't it?
But it would ring and it would
you would see that in every
change so much.
Yeah.
You would see it
if you measure water.
Hmm.
Yeah, so this huge overshoot is specifically seen in a shear startup experiment at shear rates around this region here where we'd expect to see instability. So at these lower shear rates we don't, there are oscillations, but they're not nearly as pronounced as.
So is it ringing for such a long time scale?
Yeah, I'm wondering if the ringing can go out to a second or two if you have a viscous enough medium in the gap.
That's a huge overshoot in that region was seen in the original Rehaga half-time experiments in the 80s, and there the timescales are longer, I think, and you still see it. So the bit where it just goes off the plot and then comes back again is very similar to what they had then, so I'm pretty sure it's a real effect.
Okay. Oh, in fact, I'm not quite finished with that. Can we throw it away? So it looks like there's some sort of instability going on here then. So a natural question to ask is whether there is an analogy with the instability that we see in conventional fluid-fluid demixing in first-order phase separations, in particular whether there's a selected Lund scalar which inhomogeneity first appears, and this has come out particularly badly. But so again, courtesy of Sandra LaRouge, when you image the system directly at the time just after a point of inflection before this overshoot here, you do see characteristic striations appearing unsurprisingly nearer the inner wall where the stress field is higher. And then perhaps more convincing evidence comes from small angle light scattering, like so. So this is the vorticity velocity plane and the velocity gradient velocity plane. And one sees speckle patterns with an apparently selected length scale, like so. So one thing you'll notice looking at these, actually, I hadn't particularly been going to go into this much detail this early on, is that so the shear field is like so, and one would usually expect to see concentration fluctuations along the compression axis of the shear, but we notice that these are at 90 degrees to those, which anyone who knows about the work that's been done in coupling of concentration to flow, that's by Scott Milner. This is quite suggestive, but I perhaps won't pursue that at this stage. But so can I remove this now? Are you done with that? Yeah. So that's the experimental evidence then. Onto the theory. As a preamble, can we draw any analogy out of the Korn-Hilliard fluid-fluid demixing calculation, obviously done at zero shear rate? So we consider a two-fluid mixture of micelles for our purposes of volume fraction phi. Actually, I'll sloppily refer to phi often as concentration throughout this talk. I always mean volume fraction, but I use volume fraction and concentration interchangeably. And solvent, and we assume an initial state which is basically homogeneous, concentrations homogeneous throughout the cell, with some noisy fluctuations, like so, decomposed into Fourier modes. And I've drawn the homogeneous state in a rather exaggerated Fourier mode of wavelength 2 pi over k here. And then we ask if the system's stable to these noisy fluctuations. So we need some dynamics, courtesy of Korn-Hilliard. It's a Korn-Hilliard equation here, with a free energy which has a homogeneous piece and an interfacial term, which says that the system's reluctant to form interfaces, sharp interfaces. And so when we plug this linearized form into this dynamical equation, we find a growth rate for a fluctuation of wave vector k, which has a piece that's always negative, this interfacial term. So the system's reluctance to form interfaces always inhibits the instability. And then a bit that arises from this homogeneous part of the free energy, a diffusive piece, which can either be positive or negative, depending on the sign of this diffusion coefficient, which is just the curvature of the free energy, or equivalently can be cast into the form of a first derivative of the homogeneous part of the chemical potential. And so when this has suggestively negative slope, like so, when the diffusion coefficient is negative, then we find that the growth rate is positive over at least some range of length scales. And we can understand the form of this plot, realizing, as I've said, it's cut off at short length scales by the interfacial terms, and then at very long length scales. So concentration is a conserved variable, so to achieve a fluctuation, we can't just bubble concentration up out of nowhere, we have to move it around the cell. And so to move it longer and longer distances takes longer time, which goes as length squared in a diffusion process. And the interplay between these two processes gives a characteristic peak in this dispersion relation. And because we're talking exponential growth, this peak completely dominates the instability, so there's a selected length scale at which inhomogeneity first appears. So can we exploit these ideas then to try and model the initial appearance of inhomogeneity in the banding process? So this slide is not meant to be a particularly rigorous calculation, but it's just a first step towards using these ideas in a rheological context. So now we think that the relevant variables would be shear rate and stress, rather than necessarily concentration at first sight anyway. And so we assume a homogeneous shear field like so, and then consider noisy fluctuations about that. With, again, decomposed into Fourier modes with a wave vector, which I've assumed to lie in the velocity gradient direction. This drawing is actually a bit misleading because this here is the velocity field. So the shear rate will be like that, and the wiggles like so. So with a vector in the velocity gradient direction, I'm not meant to be any component of this wiggle in the flow direction. Of course, if I were doing the calculation properly, I should include fluctuations in all directions. So the motivation for just looking in this direction is that, well, that's the most obvious one at first sight, because that's the direction in which the bands ultimately form, in this system at least. In addition to which, any fluctuation that emerges with its wave vector component in the flow direction would get convected around by the flow, although that argument runs into difficulties in certain regimes. And the final motivation is that it makes the theory a heck of a sight easier, and we actually have to get into quite gnarly maths. But that is actually in progress. I'm investigating fluctuations in the entire flow gradient plane. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm only going to be considering fluctuations with our wave vectors in the flow gradient direction.
So, is it clear that you need the stress?
The stress?
That you've got the two variables there in the...
I have actually, but...
In case you only take one.
Yes, but actually this, if you look here, I'm actually only including a dynamical equation for one of them, and I'm assuming that this is adiabatic. So in a sense, I mean, this is a simplification. I'm not allowing the stress to have any dynamics, so...
Which I guess answers my question.
This implies something about the analogous free energy?
Well, you have to be very careful, obviously, because this is a driven non-equilibrium system, so you can't really rely on any underlying free energy to tell you anything. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So you need dynamical equations, which in the Carnot-Hilliard case you derive from an underlying free energy, but now we don't have the luxury of that free energy, but we can still derive dynamical equations, which is what we do here. So we now have two order parameters. Well, we don't quite, because I'm not allowing the stress to have any dynamics of its own at the moment. And so we write down equations for these order parameters. So the conventional force balance equation, which is usually rho, dTV, I've actually derived that once with respect to the flow gradient, like so, so it may look slightly unfamiliar. A constitutive equation for the stress as a function of strain rate, and then when we combine those into first order in gradients, we get this equation here, which we see is just of the form of the diffusive piece of the Carnot-Hilliard equation with a diffusion constant that's just the slope of the flow curve. So then we see a growth rate for a fluctuation at wave vector k, which has a time scale set by the negative of the slope of the flow curve. So when the flow curve has negative slope, then the system's unstable. And the dispersion relation in this rather unrealistic model is just pure diffusive. So it suggests that the system's unstable to arbitrarily small wavelengths. And that's because at the moment we haven't put any interfacial effects in, which we will do later on. So.
So this is, as you say, this is only valid for omega less than...
Yes, so I was just going to... Exactly. So there are lots of simplifications here. I've neglected interfaces. I've assumed the stress is just a scalar. I've not considered normal stresses. And probably most importantly, as Tom's just pointed out, this should really be a dt of the stress, has its own dynamics. And in fact, that's likely in most regimes of interest to us to be the limiting timescale, because we usually assume that the Reynolds number is very low. So it was just to take us in the direction of, sure.
Well, I don't quite get the dimensions of that growth rate, but maybe this is
a point. Yeah, so I always... Oh, sorry, there should be a row under there, shouldn't there? I messed up there. Perhaps the dimensions still aren't right.
The way this makes dimensions...
Yeah, I dimensionalised the...
Then the derivative kind of sigma dimensional distance. Dimensions 1 over shear rate.
So how can we use those simple ideas then in a more realistic model? So now we're getting onto the theory proper. So using the so-called diffusive or non-local version of the Johnson-Segmann model, so diffusive, it has non-local interfacial terms, and playing the usual game, now stress is a tensor of homogeneous plus a noise, and examining the stability to these fluctuations. So now the dynamical equation is essentially the same as before. There's the force balance equation now in tensorial form, and the viscoelastic stress we assume is a sum of a slow viscoelastic part from the micelles and then the usual high shear rate Newtonian shear contribution. And so now we allow, so this micellar part I've decomposed into the product of a modulus and a micellar strain, which is a strain relative to some local unstrained state, and it's this variable that I give Johnson-Segmann dynamics to. So this equation looks a bit nasty, but it's quite straightforward really. So this is the rate of change of the micellar strain in a fluid element that's translating and rotating with the flow. So we need this derivative just to impose the proper invariance on the problem. And then in that frame, the micelles are being stretched by the shear field with a linear term and a non-linear piece here. And then the important feature of the Johnson-Segmann model is this slip parameter here, A. If this were equal to 1, this would just recover the upper convective Maxwell model. But the important point of the Johnson-Segmann model is this is usually less than 1. And when it is, that says that the flow field, if you will, gets an imperfect grip on the micelles, and they're not being stretched affinely by the flow. They're slipping relative to the flow. And so this can allow shear thinning, so much so that we see the negative slope in the flow curve, which obviously we need to allow a banding instability. And then there's the usual Maxwell relaxing.
Sure. Just ask you a question about that. I mean, isn't it a bit risky to identify too much physics in the Johnson-Segmann model, although it's called the slip parameter, which is suggestive, because doesn't any value of A less than 1 give you ringing in a startup anyway, the shear stress?
Yes, it does, yeah.
But that would not be, are you saying that's physical?
What's so you're talking about, so ringing in startup, this is these oscillations in the stress.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, to my mind, that's a slightly separate issue from the fact that ultimately the system is unstable to banding. But I agree that this is a phenomenological parameter that's inserted to give the flow curve a negative slope.
I'm just suggesting that that ringing phenomenon ought to just wave it as a warning flag over necessarily mapping the physics.
Sure. I was just trying to make, I mean, really, there's a proper microscopic model by Mike Gates for these micelles, but it would be quite hideous to.
You turn on the flow against stable region
of micelles. Yeah. But not the stable region. This has ringing in stable region.
No, but the micelles have. If ringing is this overshoot, then. Okay, so
yeah,
the data.
They don't ring in the stable region. This
doesn't.
They
can ring in the stable region.
So how exactly are you defining ringing? Like, is this banding or just
the
wiggles towards.
In this equation, don't you include a vorticity term?
A vorticity term?
Term which involves the vorticity of the flow field rather than. The D is just
it's in the time part.
Yeah, it's
Or it's co-rotational.
Yeah, this has the rotation in this derivative here. Yeah.
Then may I make a remark on that A and this notion slip coefficient?
Mm-hmm.
The structure of this equation can be derived from different physical bases.
Yes.
For instance, if one starts from a Fokker-Planck equation for a stiff orientable particle in one. Finds a term which is not 1 or plus or minus 1 as
right,
in a convective. It's, if I recall correctly, like 5.37 or 6.7 something.
Right.
One can even derive it from a substance of spherical particles if one goes along the terms kind of Maxwell model.
Mm-hmm.
Then it depends on the interactions between these particles. So
mm-hmm.
there are many physical bases which lead to equations which have the same structure as this Johnson.
Mm-hmm. So just
not necessarily slip.
Can I just clarify what the point of
I just wanted to come back to Tom's point, because you were saying that in the region where the system doesn't shear bound, so where the flow curve is monotone increasing, this equation predicts overshoots in the startup.
Yes.
And actually they're
undershoots
and everything else as well. But actually they are seen in micellar systems. So the data I showed you here was slightly unrepresentative, and in fact all those overshoots were buried in the very early time bit of the plot. So that is quite commonly observed.
So
do you want to add something
else? Without these extra terms that you're putting into the Johnson-Segmann model, there would still be predictive
overshoot.
Even
with
mm-hmm.
A equals 0, you probably
get. Yes.
This comes from the
co-rotational
term.
Do you, well, A is 1. I don't know that there are
one.
Actually in the.
Well, the vorticity makes the oscillations from the vorticity term, co-rotational term, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's what brings in the periodicity.
So when A is less than 1, it means that the stretching component of the flow is less effective than the rotation component.
Exactly.
Of the flow.
Yeah.
And you'd even the same thing if you just shear and you have no oscillations because you're just shearing lines out and down like this. But the moment it starts to slip, the rotation you get things which tumble a bit. And that's what describes the oscillations.
Yep.
Which gets back to my question before, I'm not gonna let it go away so easily. if Anthony Barrett were here or any of the other members of the non-equilibrium thermodynamics cult, they would say even in driven systems you can talk about free energy, and here there's a free energy implied by this model and the previous model.
They would be wrong.
Well, there is ultimately a free energy given, because the free energy given rise to tau.
Exactly. Right.
So
exactly.
You can endow that with a free energy.
Exactly.
Well, there is information in the stresses as well.
Yeah. Well, for the sake of us all, could you elaborate, Mike?
Yes. Well, I'm curious about what this implies about oscillations and entropy or energy.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last comment there.
I'm just curious about what this implies about oscillations and entropy or energy.
Okay, well, I'm afraid I'm aware that there is this field of trying to invoke free energy's flow situations, but I'm afraid I don't know anything about it particularly, so I can't really answer that question. If anyone else wants to, then.
Right.
I think it's straightforward.
Yeah. Okay.
There are models where these questions have to be solved or addressed.
Yeah, that's true of some models. There are models which you can derive from free energy, and there are others which you can't. I mean,
there are terms in the equation which have to do with the free energy, and there are other terms which are not, like just the vorticity term. You kind of embed it in the energy function. You go beyond some. If you go to a non-rotational flow, then you can derive everything.
That's right. There's time structure invariance can tell you something about those rotational laws.
Okay, so
probably.
I can advertise this topic will be chewed upon when Scott Miller is here during the attacking session.
So I got as far as a slip parameter, I think. So this is the flow stretching out the polymeric component, and less effective if this parameter here, A, is less than 1, which allows non-monotonicity in the flow curve. Then there's the usual relaxation term with a Maxwell time, which in general depends on volume fraction, and then the interfacial term, like so, with this here is the mesh size, which sets the length scale for any interfaces in the problem. So this defines the first version of the model, in which I'm not allowing concentration to be a dynamical variable that can fluctuate during the banding process, although the various model parameters do nonetheless depend on concentration. And you immediately become very suspicious because I've got at least 6 parameters here that we can think of needing values for. So there's the density, the plateau modulus, the viscosity, the slip parameter, the Maxwell time, and the mesh size. So you can really fit whatever you want with that, can't you? But I have actually made some attempt to get values from those from experiments. In fact, I've taken them directly from the PhD thesis of Sandra LaRouge at a volume fraction of 0.11. And then obviously I could investigate the behavior of the model by then separately tuning all of these parameters about those values to see what goes on. That's a bit of a tall order in a 6-dimensional parameter space. So instead I've assumed the scaling laws, which you can find in the literature for how these parameters depend on concentration. And then I'm using concentration to dial up different behaviors of the model. Sure.
You are putting it in a pessimistic version of this number of parameters. There are many parameters which can be fixed, at least in principle, by experiment.
Yeah, I've just
go
said that I have to.
Go to the homogeneous situation, measure the stress relaxation to get one time. Measure the
exactly, yep.
Non-Newtonian and the normal pressure differences, which are sensitive to A. And in principle, many of these, I would say at least 4 of the 6 parameters can be determined independently.
Yeah, but I'm saying that if I were an unprincipled theorist, I could choose values for them as I wanted. But I'm saying that I haven't done that. So I've taken the plateau modulus from linear rheology in Sandra's experiments and so on and so on. So I just wanted to reassure you that I do have some morals, indeed. So this is the model, and we play the usual game of a homogeneous state and looking at the stability of noisy fluctuations, but we first need to do a bit of work to find the relationship between the stress and the strain rate in the background homogeneous state. So when we do that, so we disable all the time and space derivatives in the equations and find the background homogeneous states, and the shear stress related to the strain rate gives us the intrinsic flow curves like so. So this is for the values of the parameters taken from Sandra LaRouge's thesis, and then using the scaling relations of how these behave with concentration, as we tune concentration downwards, we get to a critical concentration at which this bit of negative slope goes away. And I just want to make a quick point of connection again with the experiments here. So this is some data which was in Jean-François Béret's talk the other day. And so this is now the steady state flow curve for a system of worm-like micelles. So we have the plateau instead of the wiggle. But we see with concentration, as you tune concentration downwards, this plateau region goes away, terminating in something like a critical point here. And you're obviously suspicious that the trend here is upwards and not downwards, but this data has been normalized in a different way from my data. So that explains this.
Do you happen to know what happens to the normal stress for that region? I've forgotten.
Yeah, it goes at monotone increasing.
Is it
all of them?
Is it roughly linear gamma over gamma squared? Or?
It's so if B is 1 minus A squared, it's B gamma dot squared over 1 plus B gamma dot squared is a linear combination of the XX and YY, and the ZZ is just zero.
The thing you just said sounded like it saturates, actually.
It does saturate. Sorry, so yeah, monotone increasing, saturating to zero slope. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excuse so it doesn't have any negative.
In your model, the plateau is in the low concentration, while in the experiment it's in the high.
No, it's not. It's the same way around, if you look at this. So this is 0.11, 0.11, 0.015, 0.015, and then this, so this is a fraction, this is a percentage, 12% and 2%, so it's the same way.
12% it's 11, it's 0.12?
Yes.
Exactly, yeah. I didn't rig this, honest gov. Yeah. So those are the background states about which we look at fluctuations now. Never into this overlay business, it never seems to work, but there we go, it seems to. Yeah, PowerPoint is the way forward. So when we do the linear stability analysis, then we find that the growth rate of a fluctuation at wave vector k emerges as the eigenvalue of a stability matrix, which follows from the dynamical equation and depends on the background state at any given gamma dot, and then there's the eigenvector here to order, first order in the fluctuations. And expectedly, we find that the region of instability is where the flow curve has a negative slope, like so, with a spinodal thus. So the system's unstable in the region that the flow curve has negative slope. And the dispersion relation, we can, so log of the growth rate against the wave vector, we can understand the form of this. So this is done with the boundary conditions at fixed average strain rate for the cell as a whole. So there's a diffusive piece here going as k squared, and this is finite Reynolds number effect. So there's a conserved variable here, which is now the average strain rate for the cell as a whole. So this, the rate limiting step here is the rate at which strain rate can be shifted around across the cell. And then at shorter length scales, there's a crossover intra-regime in which the strain rate transport and momentum is no longer the rate limiting step, but rather the rate at which the micellar, the slow micellar stress can respond. So in units of the Maxwell time, the rate just scales as minus the slope of the flow curve. So I've set the Maxwell time to 1, and then brought down by the usual interfacial term here. But for the experimental parameter values for the systems of interest to us, the system size here is here. So obviously we must throw all this stuff here away, because the harmonics have to fit into the cell. So we notice now that there's really no selective length scale at which the homogeneity appears. So we're back to yeah, it's because, so there's this diffusive piece here, it's slower, it has a length dependence, it's slower at longer length scales because strain has to be shifted around the place. Here, the rate limiting step is the rate at which the micellar strain or stress can respond, and that's a non-conserved variable, so it can bubble up out of nowhere wherever you want it to in the cell. It doesn't have to be moved around, so there's no dependence on space, on the length scale.
Okay.
Is that?
I think that's what, it must be what I missed the first time. So you're saying if I wanted to suddenly create a shear rate disparity over a millimeter length scale or 100 micron length scale, they're going to grow at exactly the same. I still don't understand why. That's what this graph says.
Right, so here, The rate at which momentum is shifted around over these relatively short length scales is so incredibly fast compared with the rate at which the micellar strain evolves that that's not an issue. That's only an issue down here. So the rate here is limited by how quickly the micellar strain can respond to the instability. And the micellar strain doesn't care about space because it's not conserved over the cell as a whole. It can just grow up wherever it wants to do. So that's true.
Until eventually, at high wave numbers, you're trying to perform the polar chains inhomogeneously, and then starts to move.
Yep.
I mean, there's the point here that the stress is uniform everywhere. I mean, there's no spatial dependence of the stress, right? So is that the reason?
No.
That's not the reason.
No.
Well, yes.
Okay.
Do you want me to take a crack at saying what you just said? Suppose I have an initially homogeneous deformation going on, and I put on a perturbation, so I am having fluctuations in stress
or well, I guess the stress has to be uniform everywhere in the state shear flow. You've got local distortions in rate.
No, you've got local distortions in rate and stress.
At every plane, you have the same stress.
Once you're out of this region down here, I guess.
Oh, sorry, for the confusion. Yeah, so this is the so the total stress in the non-inertial regime. Yeah, sorry for the confusion. The total stress, the micellar component and the micellar stress component is constant. But
the
strain rate adjusts itself instantaneously to whatever the polymer.
Okay. Yeah. And then you're saying no matter what wavelength I put on there, the rate of growth is governed by the intrinsic dynamics of the fluid.
Exactly.
And those are the same no matter what the K is.
Yes.
I think
exactly.
I got.
Yep, so I apologize. In fact, in this equation here, this is not the total stress, this is the micellar component of the stress. I should have
it's
said
exactly
that.
It's exactly why in light, dynamic light scattering from polymer, there's this thing, the slow movement, which is not the beauty of the precise one. It's that it's effectively a flow analogy of the slow movement.
Yep. So I hope I've not made this mistake some places later on. I might have done. So be aware of that. So yeah, so there's no selected length scale is really what I wanted to say in this version of the model. So we seem to be back to the drawing board, which is nice. So that was the model. So now I'm going to allow, so the relevant fluctuating variables here, yeah, I apologise, this should be micellar stress and throughout the talk. The relevant fluctuating variables, strain rate and stress, but now also concentration. So, how do we get concentration coupling into the model?
It's green.
It's green, yes. Oh dear, that's really not worked, has it? So, just about. So now we've got a third variable, and so now we need another equation for the dynamics of the concentration. And concentration fluctuations occur when the micelles move relative to the solvent, obviously, so we have a relative velocity term in here. And so, obviously, now, so previously, in the previous version of the model, we assumed that the micelles and the solvent in any given fluid element were moving at the same rate. So now we allow them to move relative to each other. So we need to be more careful about what we actually mean by this velocity here. And this is the centre of mass velocity, likewise here. And so now we need to do a bit of work to get this relative velocity here. And we do that by using a two-fluid model in which, in any given fluid element, we don't just consider force balance for the element as a whole, but we consider force balance separately for the micellar component of the model and of the element and for the solvent component.
How about the exchange between both?
Well, I'll come on to that later. But so we write down an equation for force balance for micelles and for the solvent, and then we can effectively subtract them to get the relative motion, and then we can add them up to get the centre of mass motion. So we effectively rederive the force balance equation. When we do that, we find phi concentration couplings appear in here as well. And we also need to be careful about what we mean by the convecting velocity in the polymer stress equation here, and we take this to be the micellar component of the velocity. So now we need to do a bit of work then to derive the relative velocity and centre of mass velocity using this two-fluid model. So here goes. I'm afraid this is a bit gnarly for a slide or two. So force balance for in any given element, we're considering force balance for the micelles here. So mass times acceleration, then there's a term which says that the micelles experience a drag when they try and move relative to the solvent with a drag coefficient zeta. The usual micellar viscoelastic stress decomposed into a plateau modulus and a strain. So this strain just has the usual Johnson-Segmann dynamics, now with the velocity replaced by the micellar velocity, not just the centre of mass velocity. We've also assumed, for pragmatic purposes, a fast Newtonian term in here due to fast terms within the micelles, say Rouse modes, what have you. And then because we're allowing concentration to fluctuate now, if the micellar concentration is larger in one place than another, the micelles will experience an osmotic force tending to shift them around. So we have a free energy which we can take a derivative with respect to concentration.
But the reason you do that is because the equilibration of the variables that enter that free energy is much faster than the time scales in your flow problem. So that's why you can use a free energy and wave your hand and say on this graph.
Okay.
Is that right? That's the only reason, that the only case in which you can use and know you can get away with it, a free energy in a flow condition as well, is that free energy is only dependent on the partial subset of the variables whose relaxation dynamics are much faster than your flow.
Is that a reasonable assumption? I think that the free energy does depend on the structure variable W, and that's
sure.
The same concept.
But W depends on other modes as well. I mean, W is the end-to-end distribution, for example, which depends on all the little smaller wavelength modes, which one assumes are relaxing much faster.
Okay. So in the interest of time, and just to preempt any other questions on this, we could actually talk for at least 6 hours on the two-third model. And it's dodgy, but it's the best model, as far as I'm aware, that's on the markets for these purposes. So perhaps we could defer that to the end.
But just to check what you mean by the two-third model.
Yeah.
The two-third model has various variations on theme.
Oh, right. Well, this is the one that I'm
aware of. But this is the two-third Johnson-Sableman model, I guess.
Well, the two-fluid model, really, as far as I'm concerned, is writing down the force balance equation for the two components, and then there's always a slow stress that appears in here, and then you can choose your dynamics for that. Exactly. And we're choosing the Johnson-Sableman dynamics so that we can have this negative slope for the flow curve business.
And I do agree with what you just said.
Right. Okay. So, and then there's the usual pressure thing in there. And then we do... phew. And then we do the same force balance for the solvent here, mass times acceleration, the counterpart of the drag term in here, the usual solvent Newtonian term and a pressure term.
Can I just ask though, sure. You've got an eta m.
Yes.
That's a Newtonian piece which comes from...
from the micelles,
yeah.
Yes.
And so then is the solvent viscosity you had before the sum of those two etas?
The solvent viscosity is just the viscosity of water.
Yeah, but in the linear asymptote to your flow curve, does it contain both those pieces or just this one?
At the high shear rates.
Yes.
It's the sum of those, yeah. Okay. Thanks.
You keep a Newtonian looking bit, which nonetheless does come from the micelles.
Yeah. If you were going to write down the model from scratch as we did, we didn't actually have this in to start with, but we found that we needed to put it in for reasons which I'll discuss with anyone who really wants to know the gory details. But, yeah. So,
I realize there's something more fundamental that I'm missing. Who's to say you're wrong that there is no selective K? Your transition to this part of your talk was that, well, we know there's a selective K, so...
Well, we do in some systems, but, I mean, there may not be in all systems, yeah.
I think it may be that in some systems there is no selective K.
Yeah. Perhaps I should motivate concentration. In fact, yes, I forgot to do that. I should motivate that in a bit more detail. So we do need more experiments. So there are various bits of evidence that concentration coupling should play an important role. So one reason that we know is that in the steady state flow curve, so the usual argument is that we have a bit going up and then a dead straight plateau that's flat and then a bit going up. But actually, in many systems, that plateau that should be flat seems to have a bit of slope to it. And as Carlos Marquez originally pointed out, that suggests concentration coupling. Then we also saw some of the experimental evidence that I presented earlier was light, unpolarized light scattering, which couples to concentration in those experiments that I showed you. So, and indeed, concentration, the coupling of concentration to flow has been investigated at low shear rates, sort of ad nauseam, really, and has been shown to produce some very interesting effects. So I just wanted to investigate how those affected this particular instability. So sorry, I should have said all that before. So, are we any closer to our final dynamical equation? So force balance for the micelles and the solvent, as I said, we can add them up to get the force balance equation and subtract them. Well, so we add them up to get rho dTV is a blah, and then we subtract them. There should actually be an inertial term in here as well, but if the drag is large enough, which it is, then that the relative inertial term turns out to be negligible, which is nice because then we get an algebraic equation for the relative velocity, which can just be substituted directly into the continuity equation for the concentration fluctuations. So after a bit of a sweat, then we've got the final dynamical equations. So the two we've just derived from the two fluid model, the force balance equation and the continuity. So this is what you would have written down without too much thought about it. The physics of the two fluid model now is that we have a piece of stress in the force balance equation that comes from osmotic forces rather than just the standard viscoelastic forces. And this is the continuity equation you would have written down in your sleep as well. This is just the diffusion equation. And then the physics of the two fluid is that we have viscoelastic terms added onto here as well, so coupling everything together. And then, as before, we have Johnson-Segelman dynamics for the slow part of the micellar stress.
Are a number of sins covered in the functional derivative here by the five there? You've got gradient terms and correlation there. That's not the ordinary derivative. In the dashed box in the
Horstmann
equation.
This here. Yep.
It's got undashed there, but the one above. In the force balance equation, delta F by delta phi.
Yes, it's a functional it is a functional derivative. It is a mess. It is quite a horrible mess. Yeah.
That's
what
I'm sure.
Because it includes G. So I babysat the algebra quite closely in Maple when I produced the stability matrix, and it was about 6 pages of Emacs C code. Yeah, I did the algebra in Maple, making sure I didn't produce too much, and it gave me about 6 pages of C code for the matrix. So, yes. So it is a bit of a mess. So this is the form of the two fluid equation that's been written down in the literature in lots of other places before. It's dodgy. The only thing we're doing differently is that we have this thing in here. And if anyone can come up with a better way of coupling to concentration, then I'd love to know about it. But we have thought about this quite a lot. So now we do the usual homogeneous shear state and fluctuations about that. And so in a homogeneous state, the concentration is by definition homogeneous. So the only relevant bit of this these equations are the bits that we had before. So the underlying homogeneous constitutive curves are just the curves that I showed you before. And then we consider fluctuations about these curves. And the point is now that we're allowing not only the micellar strain and the strain rate to fluctuate, but also the concentration. So the stability matrix then, from which we get the eigenvalues, which are the growth rates of the instability, now has, you can think of as having, as a caricature, two different subspaces. The one that has strain rate and, sorry, the micellar stress, not the total stress in here, and the concentration in here. And when we look at the possible sources of instability now in the model, there's the mechanical instability that we had in the first version of the model. So when the flow curve has negative slope, we can get an instability. But now also in the phi subspace, we've just got the regular Kohn-Hilliard instability when the diffusion constant is negative. But really the point of the two-fluid model is that we have cross terms like so, and the most which can couple these instabilities together and enhance the instabilities. And the most important coupling from our point of view arises from an interplay of this term here with this one. So when the normal component of the micellar stress, the YY component, goes up, the concentration goes up, and when the concentration goes up, if the plateau modulus increases with concentration, the normal stress goes up. So that's a positive feedback loop which can enhance the instability. And I should point out the coupling of concentration to flow has been investigated before, originally by Schmidt, Marquez and Bakker, by Helfand and Fredrickson, by various other people, Scott Milner, Tom McLeish, Nigel Clark, etc., and has very interesting effects, but mostly been investigated at low shear rates, and we're now going to investigate the interplay of these couplings of concentration and flow with the banding instability. So when we look at the stability of fluctuations then about these intrinsic flow curves, which is the same as they were before. So, actually there's just one thing I want to say in relation to the previous slide. So we've shown then that concentration fluctuations are coupled to the fluctuations in what I'll call, for the purposes of this talk, the mechanical variables. I think mechanical instability is a bit of an abused term, but for the purposes of this talk, any instability in this subspace that's purely in this subspace I'll call mechanical. And then there's this coupling between the mechanical and the Kohn-Hilliard demixing sort of instability, except there's a limit that we can take when we take this drag to be very large, which disables any fluctuations in concentration. And then concentration remains uniform, and we're back to the original version of the model that we had, in which only the mechanical variables are fluctuating. Equivalently, there's a slightly different limit we can take, in which we still take the drag to be very large, but in which the diffusion constant that's implied by this term here remains fixed. And then we still get a decoupling between the mechanical subspace and the concentration subspace, and each can fluctuate independently, and these cross-couplings are irrelevant. And that's an uncoupled limit that I'll make point of contact with in several places in giving the results. So the intrinsic flow curves then, and then we consider fluctuations about them. In the uncoupled limit, the spinodal is just, as I said, what it was before. So where the flow curve has a negative slope, we see a purely mechanical instability. And then when we allow concentration fluctuations, the spinodal is broadened away from the previous region of instability, like so. And we can come up with an expression actually just for the lower spinodal, just for the sake of simplicity. So the position of the spinodal is given by the product of the... So in the uncoupled limit, we ignore all of this, and we just have this bit equal to zero. And because we're only interested in systems which have a positive diffusion coefficient, collective diffusion coefficient, so that they're stable in zero shear, the condition for the instability is just the slope of the flow curve being zero, or the onset of the instability, the condition for the spinodal. But the point is, when we allow coupling, the spinodal shifted by this term here. So this is stupid notation. This is the derivative of the plateau modulus with respect to concentration. It's not the dependence of the dynamic modulus with respect to concentration. No, indeed. So coupling has shifted the spinodal by order, this derivative over the drag times the diffusion coefficient, but this is just the osmotic compressibility. So the spinodal shifted by an amount that depends on the elasticity that's buried in this term and the osmotic elasticity buried in this term here. And we see that, okay, so there are three extra parameters in this coupled version of the model, which again I've taken from experiments at a particular concentration and then tuned with concentration. And for the systems of interest to us, that gives us this spinodal here, which is only shifted a little bit from the raw mechanical spinodal. However, if we artificially ask what would happen if we chose the diffusion coefficient at our reference value of concentration to be artificially much lower, we find the spinodal is shifted to very low shear rates. And here the system really doesn't even know that there's this piece of negative slope in here. So this, we can think of this, if you will, as a Carnot-Hilliard instability that's perturbed by weak shear. Whereas in this limit here, we've got essentially a mechanical instability perturbed by a coupling to concentration. And I think this instability, this type of, this extreme of instability is the sort that's been investigated by previously by Nigel Clark and Tom McLeish and Scott Milner and Inuki and several authors. But the point is really that we have a smooth crossover between the two extreme types of instability going from mechanical over to essentially Carnot-Hilliard. And
haven't made
Digo negative, no.
So that's a shear-induced
shear-induced demixing.
But that is something which Scott and both have looked at.
Perturbing one we sort of hanging
about.
Now I remember.
Yes, it did do that, didn't it?
Derivative of that black chi is with respect to
concentration. Yeah, whenever I write down the function prime.
Plus prime is, and the upper prime is derivative with respect to shear rate.
Yes, so whenever I write function prime thing parameter, it's with respect to that parameter. So we'd expect in these two extremes then different signatures for the instability. In particular, where it's mostly mechanical, perturbed a bit by flow, we expect the eigenvector to be mostly in the mechanical variables of strain rate, micellar component of the stress with just a little bit of concentration, conversely in this other limit at low shear rates here. So what do the dispersion relations look like then before I go on to talk about the eigenvector? So this is the uncoupled limit here, and then I plotted here the dispersion relation, so omega is a function of log k at a given various given slices of gamma dot. And I've restricted myself so far to low shear rates because there are various nasties that appear at high shear rates that I might discuss later this time. But there's good justification for focusing on low shear rates because I'm told by the experimentalists that to actually do a shear an instability experiment, anything much beyond the spinodal is a bit of a ridiculous feat anyway because the whole thing gets so unstable that it's really hard to do. So this is just the dispersion relations that we saw before, the broad plateau with no apparent selective Lund scale, again the system size here. And then when we shifted the spinodal a bit by coupling to concentration, so still basically mechanical but with a bit of concentration fluctuation, we see that a bump appears here. So hey, we have a selective Lund scale, which is now nice. And then when we in this extreme down here, the same qualitative features, but now the bump is much more pronounced and the spinodal shifted to much lower shear rates. And so what are the main features of these dispersion relations then? Well, I've taken these two slices here. So the same features really in both these cases, but more pronounced here. So this is the raw Johnson-Sagerman without any coupling to concentration. And then when we allow coupling to concentration, we see a shift by order the amount the spinodal was shifted by. And how do we understand where this peak is? Well, it's actually easiest to look down here because it's in more or less the same place. And when we do that, we see that there's this diffusive branch here with an effective diffusion coefficient that's minus the raw diffusion coefficient. So that would cause the system to be stable, if anything. But then it's made to be positive by the coupling between concentration and flow. And then brought down by interfaces like so. And so now there's a selected Lund scale that's just set by the interplay between this effective diffusion coefficient and the interface width. I should say I've exaggerated this diagram somewhat because there's a broad peak, there's a pronounced peak here. But if we artificially tune the interfaces to be much shorter than they are in real life, then there's actually another non-conserved region in here. And the time scale is here set by the Maxwell time and the slope of the flow curve, but just enhanced by this bit here. But so the main thing I want to get over is that here the timescale for the instability is still fundamentally set by the Maxwell time of the material, which will be something that's important later on.
And these reminders, what you tuned, go down those three dispersion relations?
So I've tuned the value of the raw diffusion coefficient. Yep.
Can I give the value for K star in order of magnitude?
Yep. It's about a 20th or 100th of the system size, which is roughly what's seen in the experiment.
So. It does depend on the system size, not on the size associated.
No, it happens to be, for these particular systems, 20th or 100th of the system
you
size.
The length scale. The system sets the length scale.
No, the system doesn't set the length scale. It's the interplay between these two things that sets the length scale, and it happens to be,
the interfacial term which probably sets the length scale.
It's the interplay between this effective diffusion coefficient and the
interface.
I'm sorry?
That's the L squared you have in front of the second derivative and that equation for the
exactly. Yeah.
Order tensor.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a 20th system when the system is a millimeter. Right?
Yep.
Now, I don't follow this whole literature. I didn't see that in any of the talks here. So, who has seen banding with a refined length scale that subsequently, I presume,
coarsens? So this is the initial stage of the band, and then you'd expect coarsening.
Right. So
well, the experiments like photographs you showed at the beginning, bearing the thesis.
I thought we saw something quite like that in the other building last Tuesday afternoon.
They did see banding coarsening.
Well, it's only striations, and whether they're coarsening or just doing something a bit bizarre, it's not so easy to say, but there was certainly striking. I thought so, but I can't. But that's different, that's shifting, so you don't make comparison. Okay.
Well, we need more experiments on here
we do. So I could now go on to
easy issue. What's early? A time scale which is within a few seconds of switching it on?
Yeah, I'm actually going to come on to talk about that a bit more, so it may be better to postpone that too. So I could then go on to present the eigenvector at the peak of these dispersion relations and tell us all about the nature of the instability. But first I just want to address something that you've probably been wondering about during the talk. So far, the dispersion relations that I've presented and the stability analysis I've done is has been about a homogeneous state on the underlying flow curve. And that's an okay thing to do if you consider tracking the system towards the unstable region from outside the unstable region, because you can have a homogeneous state on the stable bit of the flow curve. And then when that first becomes unstable, that defines a spinodal. So I don't think there's any complaint there. But whether these dispersion relations are of any use actually deep inside the unstable region is a bit questionable, in fact very questionable, because really you couldn't actually prepare the system in initial state, homogeneous state, on the unstable bit of the flow curve, because it's unstable by definition. So we actually need to do something a bit more careful and think about what's actually done in the experiments, which is a startup quench where you quench the shear rate into the unstable region and ask what happens. So we run back to our Carnot-Hilliard analogy again to see if it can give us any help with this. So the Carnot-Hilliard analogy then is the chemical potential as a function of, as a function of concentration, which for various temperatures looks like so. And the usual thing you do is quench from a high temperature into the unstable regime. And you assume that when you do that, the heat can get out quickly enough that the system goes from being in a homogeneous state on this curve to one on this curve. And then you examine fluctuations about this here. But this involves the assumption that the conduction timescale for getting the heat out is much less than the timescale on which the instability grows. And I think that's probably a reasonable thing to do in this case, but for our case it actually isn't, which is a bit of a nuisance. So we consider what actually happens in a startup experiment. So you start one plate moving. The instant you do that, there's a delta function of shear rate at the wall you've just started moving. Then it diffuses across by Reynolds dynamics, effectively, across the cell and sets up a homogeneous shear rate field. And that happens very quickly, instantly, in the zero Reynolds number limit. So then we have the piece of stress that's due to the Newtonian, fast Newtonian part. But the micellar stress hasn't really woken up yet. It doesn't realise that it's being sheared because it can only respond on the Maxwell time. And then it wakes up on the Maxwell time and starts to grow towards the underlying flow curve. But we know that the system's unstable by the time it gets there. And in fact, we find that the dispersion relation, which is now time dependent, becomes positive before it gets here. So the timescale on which this grows towards the intrinsic flow curve is set by the Maxwell time. And I just told you that the timescale of the instability is also set by the Maxwell time. So we can't do this separation of timescales. So we explicitly now have to consider a homogeneous background state in which the micellar stress is just bubbling up out of nowhere, which is time dependent, and linearize about that. So the whole problem gets nasty and time dependent, and we have to do lots of nasty history integrals and so on, which is in progress. But it turns out that you can still glean the main features of the instability by looking at the time dependent eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the stability matrix, which gives us a time dependent growth rate effectively. So just to conclude then, I want to present results for these, for two separate startup experiments for the time dependent dispersion relations and eigenvectors. So separately, I want to consider, so this is the, these are the spinodals as established by the slow shear rate sweep. This is in the Johnson-Segmer model, not coupled to concentration, then shifted slightly by a coupling to concentration for the experimental system's interest to us. And for this system, I'm going to consider a shear rate here. And I'll come back to this plot in a minute. So just to do that. So this is basically, we expect an instability that looks mostly mechanical with a bit of concentration thrown in. And the first thing we notice, the dispersion relation is time dependent, starts negative and then becomes positive. And it has the same features that I pointed out before. It's just growing up out of the floor now. I've hidden something here, which I'm not going to tell you about. And so the eigenvector at the peak of the dispersion relation now, we see that it's mostly in the mechanical variable. So this is a strain rate in various components of the micellar stress. And then the thing that we notice is that the concentration plays very little role in here. So this is essentially of a mechanical type of instability. And then coming back to this plot, we consider separately what happens in a system that's diffusion coefficient is very small, so that it's near to an underlying Carnot-Hilliard instability that now gets shifted by the flow. And we consider shear startup at this shear rate here. And when we do that, so in fact the time dependence in this case isn't that crucial because we see that the dispersion relation becomes time independent even over the times we need to consider for the instability. But so the dispersion relation has the same feature that I pointed out before. The raw Johnson-Segmer shoulder's gone away now. And the eigenvector is mostly in the concentration direction as we expected. So this is mostly a Carnot-Hilliard type of instability perturbed by a coupling to flow. I had a couple of slides on effects that you see at very high shear rates, but perhaps in the interest of time, I'll just not show those. If anyone wants to know, they can ask. So to conclude then, purely mechanical instability, and I use the word mechanical to refer to when the instability is purely in the strain rate and stress degrees of freedom, is enhanced by coupling to concentration and then has a selected wavelength, wave vector. There are two extreme types of instability, mechanical, slightly perturbed by phi coupling, and a Carnot-Hilliard demixing instability, slightly perturbed by flow, and we have a smooth crossover between these types of instability. And then suggestions for outlook. So I need to look at fluctuations in the whole velocity-velocity gradient plane in progress, integrate explicitly the time-dependent problem to find the static structure factor, which is now time-dependent. It's not a dynamic structure factor, it's a time-dependent static structure factor. Look at the later stages of the unstable kinetics and any coarsening that happens. Separately, we could look at the metastable kinetics and ultimately the steady-state phase diagram of this model. But ideally look at other models than the two-fluid model, which are ideally microscopic and not so dodgy in their assumptions. So thank you for listening.
I have a question about what structure factor you'd be solving for. So you're not solving for the detailed orientation distribution of the micelles, you're just solving for the density profile as a function of Q and time.
Well, we could solve for lots of different structure factors, actually. The structure factor is a matrix which involves on-diagonal couplings between concentration and concentration, and separately between, I'm about to cough again, between the micellar stress components, and then you could look at those in birefringence experiments.
So there is a level of detail under there, deeper than just the mean concentration locally. It could have your...
Yeah, we can do that. That calculation's on my computer as we speak. Watch this space. Okay. Yeah.
If you took your model, presumably it must admit steady shear banded structures as steady solutions.
Oh, yes. Yes, in fact, that's one thing that we really want to investigate.
Just two bands.
Yep.
What's the stability characteristics of the banded states?
Well, that would be an interesting thing to investigate. In particular, you could look at the stability of fluctuations. So that we've done it, the way that I'd initially solve those is in a one-dimensional scenario in which we only look at the profile in the velocity gradient direction. But of course, really, you should look at it in the velocity gradient flow direction, and you could ask what happens to capillary fluctuations on the interface and whether they're stable in the type of analysis that Rinaldi and Rinaldi did in the Johnson-Sagan model without the interfacial terms, for example. And that's something that I'd like to do at some point.
Can you remind us what they found?
No.
Well, it's not Rinaldi. I thought Rinaldi claimed that if you just took a pure Johnson-Sagan model, that, and she was doing weakly nonlinear analysis. I thought she said that she got a solution which was stable, which always worked.
Yeah, I'd have to read that paper again.
She made, and when pressed in discussion, she appeared to say, well, perhaps the amplitude is so small that in a weakly nonlinear, there was some hedging of bets.
Oh, really? Right, so it'd be interesting to call for that again.
She claimed.
I thought there was a small sliver of unstable among the
time. In fact, you... Sorry, to...
Okay, I can't apologize or explain her work because there was someone who had
it. So Tom McLeish looked at a similar calculation. Were you in with what we've just been talking about? Capillary weight, looking at the interface and the velocity gradient.
Yes.
And you looked at a similar thing, and you found it to be stable.
Stable.
Yes, yeah.
Yes. But that was with no gradient term.
Exactly, yeah.
And the absence of a gradient term in linear perturbation induces conservation of material either side of the interface, because you can demonstrate that the general class of series equations transporting material through the interface gives whatever rate you choose a nonlinear perturbation.
Exactly,
which not allowed. But with gradient terms, you can do it smoothly, and I believe that you can change it.
And then the concentration coupling's on top of that.
Exactly.
Yep. But it is true that
it's all a horrible mess.
Normal stress is extremely important in controlling.
Well, that's interesting you raise normal stresses, because I'm still not quite clear whether the Johnson-Sagan model has the right kind of normal stresses in it.
Actually, I should make a comment in relation to that. In this talk, I only looked at fluctuations in the velocity gradient direction. You could look at them in the vorticity direction as well. Yeah, and so that was also covered in the original paper of Schmidt, Marcus, and Lecoeur, and they found an instability in the vorticity direction. But they found that, and Scott Milner also found it at the end of his long concentration fluctuations in the upper convective magma model, except that he grafted onto it a normal stress, a ZZ component of the normal stress in the background state. But the point is that this model does actually have that, and I think that's quite a necessary ingredient to get instability in the vorticity direction. So I don't know if that's relevant to what...
Well, actually,
you're
back to this thing, this endless demand for more experiments, but I've been through the banded region, there's normal stress data on the Raoul-Hoffman system, 600, horizontal stress data, 100 millibar, 60 millibar, and the normal stress goes up and up and up and up and up as you go across the band. So it's suggesting that
you're right.
The other branch here is not actually a Newtonian solvent at all, but something with immense normal stresses.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that data has been taken on any other system, actually.
Mm.
And it's not at all clear that all of these systems are the same, because you're asking partly what's the nature of the high shear ground.
And is the fluid extremely
bad? Well, yes.
How do you do an experiment where you get a stable flow? Even there, when you get those high normal stresses, you get rod climbing in cone and plate, you get free boundary movement in sliding plate, you get all kinds of problems.
Yes, which of course might make it look even bigger than everybody else.
Not particularly, as long as it's less than one.
Less than one?
As long as it's not equal to plus or minus.
What remains if it could be equal to zero?
What does zero correspond to? Is that rigid bolts or something?
Yeah.
No.
That's the maximum slip.
Equals zero sounds a bit.
A equals plus one is the upper convected, A equals minus one is the lower convected.
And A equals zero is somewhere. It just means that you get the second normal stress difference too large. If you want to make it smaller, then you need the A different from zero. More realistic. So, but if it's zero, then you have a ratio of minus 1/2 between the first and second. Between the second and the first normal stress difference.
Right. I'm not actually sure that thinking about normal stress differences in this case. I know that's
the
thing.
Come out from the model.
Yeah, but there is no ZZ component of the micellar stress, so I just find it more intuitive to think about separately the X and YY components of the micellar stress. But
the normal, the core rotation does give a second normal stress difference.
Does it?
Yeah.
It's
magnitude too large. It gives the right sign, but it's magnitude too large.
Oh, with normal stress difference, right, but it won't give a ZZ component of the normal stress.
You just elaborate on that?
It's sensitive to the absolute values of the normal stress values, not the differences.
Cares about the actual,
it does, which is something that Scott Milner pointed out in his paper.
Diagonal components,
it does.
Stress tensor, not no differences.
It does, which is something that can be measured in birefringence.
I'm just trying to wonder why, but okay, I should check that.
Okay.
You can pressurize the system and change things.
Exactly.
I mean, that's why you normally disregard it, because you can change them with a uniform pressure. So
yeah.
I find that a bit peculiar.
But excuse me,
But you can't change the micellar component. It's the micellar contribution that's important.
Micellar contribution to the YY component of stress.
It's different from the total stress. Yeah. Which is what this cares about, really. Because that's why the cross-coupling came into...
Yes. Okay, so basically the real fluid will put in there a slight compression of the solvent or whatever to fiddle the thing, so the differences matter for the explicitly for the flow, but you care how much of that has come from the micellar.
You do, for the purpose of the insertion, because the cross-coupling came between them. Yeah.
The
Paul, you had a...
Well, I have to bring up a very technical discussion.
I'd be grateful if you would.
Well, I'm going to ask a couple of naive questions. If it's clear, in this model here, as you change the value of D, the spinodal moves to the left. Does that mean if you step strain rate experiment to the left of the peak of the constitutive curve, you're going to get stabilities there?
Instabilities, yes, you are. Precisely,
right.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
The other thing is about the time scale. I mean, the time scale of these fluctuations is associated with a particular length scale now, because your curve narrows down, your spectrum narrows down.
Yep.
So what is the time scale? I mean, you've talked about a length scale that comes out to be about a 20th of a millimetre.
Sure. So in the raw Dantesheim model without concentration coupling, it was set by minus the slope of the flow curve over the Maxwell time squared, and then it's enhanced. It's still fundamentally set by that, but it's enhanced by something that depends on the amount the spinodal shifted by. So I would still say the Maxwell time rather than any Reynolds time scale for shifting things about, but it's the Maxwell time enhanced by coupling.
Right, the nature of the time variation, you never get oscillations in this model of yours, do you? You just get growth.
The eigenvalue is purely real. If it had an imaginary component, then but we don't. No, we don't.
Can you generate an imaginary component? What the case?
Possibly, yeah. Could cook up a model where you could.
Observation in space or impact?
Impact,
I think.
No, the composition, I mean, it's not the stress.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to try and cook something like that up.
So I guess what I'm asking is, can your model
oscillating?
Can your model predict the oscillations in the experimental data?
Right. Okay. That's perhaps a separate question actually, because the oscillations in the so just at the end of the talk, I talked about grafting a stability analysis onto the startup flow, and in the startup flow, the background homogeneous state about which you're linearizing is growing in time. And in fact, it's growing in time, but in the experiments and in the theory, in fact, it's growing in time and oscillating towards the underlying flow curve. And then we're thinking about fluctuations about that. So they're essentially two separate, which perhaps didn't make clear.
I didn't understand the first part of the question. What are the timescales again for that second? You said it was Maxwell enhanced, but enhanced by a lot?
Enhanced by order, the derivative of the plateau modulus over the osmotic compressibility.
That number.
Well, I'll show you. I mean, in terms of the experiments, I'm not sure this is actually massively relevant. I think the length scale is something that's more important. But so this is in units of the Maxwell time. Which I should have said. It's only good talk. Yeah.
Yes. I have a question about this K star. Apparently, this is an indication of banding. And
it's the length scale which inhomogeneities which precursor banding first appear.
Way before banding.
So in spinodal decomposition, you have an inhomogeneity appearing at a given length scale, and then it coarsens into a separated state. And this is the this is the direct analogy of something that would then coarsen into a banded state.
Do you expect that? In this first stage of this banding, you have some concentration fluctuation from one band to the other.
There's no band. We're just thinking of a sine wave, which has probably a phase factor between, maybe a phase factor, but actually not in this case, but between the concentration and the shear rate and the micellar stress.
But it corresponds with a small undulation in the concentration. So you make it a little denser here in this case. But then nothing more.
Okay. So can I just check, do you find uniquely in all your explorations this model? Take the shear perturbed Cantillon. Demixing, shear enhanced demixing.
Yes.
Or do you find regimes of both? Shear enhanced and shear suppressed demixing.
Oh, right. I've not found shear suppressed demixing.
In the
vorticity direction, it is suppressed.
That's right. I was trying to dig out my epithelial failing memory what we found, but I'm pretty sure that in the vorticity direction, you've got good shear suppression and shear enhancement. But I seem to recall that the things in model general is elastic models go almost either way in other axis depending on
the experimental
shear rate. It's not really well. There aren't really very general.
You have to put in assumptions for how things scale with phi and so on.
It's not just to do with the model in the other way, it's not really exposed.
Yeah. Any more?
If you had to say something about nucleation, before you get into the spinodal region,
nucleation. So in the metastable region,
Do you think there's any way forward with this kind of calculation that I'm telling you about?
Well, I think the thing is that this is for infinitesimally small fluctuations.
Yeah.
And when, as far as I know, Ovidiu Radulescu looked at the Johnson-Sabin model on a computer in the metastable regime, and you actually have to kick it quite hard before it will do anything, as far as I remember.
So you have to kind of put in by hand a critical droplet or something.
Something like that. So this is just infinitesimally small sine waves. I don't think we'll do anything.
But,
yeah.
Well, what you can do is obviously is if you have in mind a particular structure of the critical droplet, you can then use this to the large carbon bonds. And then that analogy of the way that the system wrapped, you can work around little droplets will give you nesting micellar. Features all around rods will give you cocoons. I wonder if you can get a hawking lad phenomenon. But it's only unstable to a global. Because the thing is that metastable branch is really metastable. And then no sign of nucleus.
We haven't looked at that in much detail at all.
The universe in a nutshell.
These were three dimensions.
Yes.
Right,
well, I think we should thank you that very much.
It's all very promising. This officially